Fishing like a local isn't just about catching fish. It's about connecting with the environment and the people who call it home. It's about hearing the stories and traditions that have been passed down for generations and sharing unforgettable moments with the people you meet along the way. Fishing like a local is having an experience that stays with you forever. And with Fishing Booker, you can experience it too, no matter where you are. Discover your next adventure on Fishing Booker.
This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
Hello and welcome to the Publicly Challenged Podcast. I'm your host, Luke Oswald, and I hope you join me on my quest for knowledge to become a better hunter, angler, and forager. Stick with us and who knows, maybe we will learn something together. Before we get to the show, I just want to mention a few things. Initial Ascent packs, they're awesome. I used a 2K all last season. I'm still using it now for stuff. I'm going to be using it for training for prepping for my hunt and getting some miles in with some weight on my back. And I just recently picked up a 6K, and it's going to be awesome as well. Plan on using it on my elk hunt along with the 2K if I'm doing some day hunts or something and having a base camp. But if I'm packing on my back and going in there, depending on where I'm at, I'm going to be using that 6K. Dennis and Joe are amazing people. What's awesome about that company is you can reach out to them, and they're the ones who are going to answer your call and actually talk to you about their product. And you're going to even get a handwritten note from them thanking you for your purchase and wishing you luck on that hunt. And I just find that is super awesome and amazing in this day and age to have somebody that does that for you and actually handwrites a note for you is just amazing. And on top of that, it's an American-made product. And one thing about this podcast is, and myself, is just that anything that's American-made that I can support or get behind and it's a quality product, I'm going to talk about it. This is not a paid promotion. I'm honestly just talking to you about an amazing pack. So check them out. If you don't have one or you're looking for a pack, give them a try. You'll like it for sure. And then on top of that, we're going to talk about treelineacademy.net. Treelineacademy.net is the most comprehensive e-scouting course ever made. Mark Livesay is just an amazing, amazing wealth of knowledge, and he's willing to share that with everybody. So check that out and see what's going on there with that. Use promo code PC2020. Save yourself 20% on sign up. It's awesome. And actually, it's not 20%. It's $20. Save yourself $20 off a sign up. Then the next one I want to talk about is Basemap. Basemap app with their hunt data, the online mapping system for e-scouting, setting waypoints, smart markers. So you have all your hunt data on the wind and anything, as long as you have a cell signal. It's absolutely amazing. There's so much more that's coming out. They've updated their offline maps, so they're way, way, way faster than they used to be, which I know a lot of people were actually kind of complaining about that, but now they're lightning fast. I've downloaded them, used them. It's awesome. On top of that, they've got some new updates that are coming out that are just going to blow you away. Can't talk about them yet, but we will be talking about them. So check them out. Use promo code PC25. Save yourself 25% on sign up, only on the website, not on the app. And with that being said, let's get to our show. All right, so I'm sitting here and I am talking to Randy Cooling. And Randy, you've got an interesting lifestyle, and I'm kind of curious to hear some stories along the way about this. So can you go ahead and introduce yourself a little bit?
Yeah, my job for 42 years is working on elevators and escalators, and I retired in January. And about a year and a half ago, I purchased Safari Tough, and I manufacture bow cases, back quivers, finger tabs, and some other things. And I'm starting to come out with some other products and working on new ones. But that's been my real passion. It seemed, and I have a very bad hunting habit, and that probably seemed more like my job than my job to my wife and other people, because I got it worked out. So I was going hunting about between 12 and 14 weeks a year, getting off my regular job to do it.
That's
so. Yeah, I was fortunate they'd let me take it off, actually.
You and I are going to have to talk after this podcast so we can figure out how I can get that much time off.
What you got to do, you got to be willing to take it unpaid. So that's the start of it.
Sure.
You know, take a lot of it unpaid anyway.
So when did you first start hunting, Randy?
I started bow hunting deer in 1974, and I started out on a... old bear. At the time it was new, it was $55. It was a Bear Super Grizzly Victor, and I had fiberglass arrows that were top of the line then.
Oh yeah.
And yeah it's just then from there I was 14 then, and in eighth grade I believe when I started. So and then it just progressed along the way, and a little tough for the first few years when you're in high school. I was playing four sports, and you know, it makes it a little harder getting out, but I always had the passion, and before I could drive, I'd get dropped off and go out and wander around the woods and stuff. And back then I was living in Iowa, and really back then there weren't hardly any deer. I mean, if you saw a couple deer, you were doing pretty darn good, little on killing one, believe really? It or not.
Now
there were no turkeys at all back then. Now I don't even know what the population is in Iowa, probably a million or something of them.
Yeah.
But I think the population back then for the whole state was like 20,000 deer, maybe. Hmm. And there's a total of 5,000 hunters, maybe. Something like that.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's crazy compared to now's numbers.
Yeah. Yeah, and I kind of got into that. A friend of mine in high school, his brother hunted, and so he started when we were younger, and then I'd go out and stay at his house and before we could drive, and we'd hike about 2 miles down to a river bottom to try and get a deer. I don't think there was much chance of it the way we were going, but but it was a lot of fun. It was a good start, good memories.
Yeah, that's like it. I tell people all the time that I remember when they were talking, and it was they were hosting meetings in different town halls with the DNR for the reintroduction of the turkey. And I keep thinking back to that. And I can't remember when it was, because I remember I was a kid, but by the time I was in high school, they actually opened up seasons. So, I mean, it was quite a successful reintroduction. Was it the same way for you?
Yeah, it was a long time though. I believe Iowa got turkeys from Missouri, because Missouri was a popular place to go turkey hunt and that. And I think they started getting them from there and transplanting them. But I don't remember when the season started there, but it had to be maybe the late 80s, okay. Around 90 or that. And it was a draw to get a tag and that, so it wasn't even that easy. They're very limited.
Yeah, I think that's how Illinois started out, and I actually put in like the first year you could. It was like 2000, I don't know, 2001, 2002, something like that. And and I drew it, and then stupid me, I never even went and hunted it. And I had the perfect spot. I ended up, something happened, I don't remember what, but I never ended up hunting it. But so let's talk about something a little more positive. So I'm just kind of curious, when did you kind of get the bug to start hunting like Western big game? And then where?
Well, yeah, what really happened is back in 81, a guy that is one of my best friends now, and I go hunting every year with, was looking for somebody to go out to Colorado elk hunting. And back then, elk license was $135. A deer license was $50. And I believe we could drive out and back, eat, buy gas and everything for about $400 a piece. And we took, it was kind of funny, but we took just a regular cab truck with an 8-foot box and four of us. And one guy crawled on top of the gear and laid on top of the gear for our, I think it was about 17-hour drive to get out there. So somebody slept on top of the gear while the other three guys sat up front.
Nice.
And then when we got into the mountains, all four of us had crammed into the front of that regular crab truck going up the mountain for 2 hours to get back into where we wanted to hunt. Yeah. You do anything back then, you know, to get out there and go. And so I remember going back then, I was pretty broke. My wife was in school and we were living in a one bedroom apartment. And I remember telling her, you know, going to her, telling her it was a chance of a lifetime. I'll never get to go again. And I she still throws that at me now and then to this day. And we were just married 40 years Sunday.
Congratulations on that.
Thanks. I think there's other people too that throw that at me too, friends now and then, that I actually said that chance of a lifetime to go on an elk hunt. So, and I think I've been almost every year since then now, at least on one elk hunt a year and sometimes two. And almost there was a couple of years I went brown bear hunting one year. I didn't make it elk hunting, but there's other years I went twice too. So
when did you, what kind of led you to want to travel overseas into different countries and kind of get into just going after,
you know,
all kinds of things?
What really got me going overseas was my dad didn't hunt at all, but he'd go with us on hunts like elk hunting, and he'd do all the cooking and cleaning, and he'd make fresh pies every day and fresh donuts. And nice. Yeah, he loved to just sit out there. We'd sit out there with mountains on both sides of us, and he would love to do that. And he always wanted to go to Africa. And so I thought, you know, I didn't have a lot of desire to do it then. And, but I thought, you know what, I want to go. I want to take him. He wants to go before he gets too old. And him and I went to Zimbabwe like in 97, I think, something like that, 98. And it really got me hooked. I love to hunt different animals. You know, some guys will just concentrate on North American stuff and that, and which I do love that. I've been all over Canada and stuff, but I love to travel, get out, see other cultures, and hunt different animals that, you know, are completely different.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. It's always kind of intrigued me because, like, you and I were talking a little bit about earlier that, you know, I always watch the Fred Bear videos, and I've got the complete series of them all, and every once in a while I'll watch them, and like the tiger in India and, you know, everything. But at the same time, I watch him go pheasant hunting and just think, man, you know what? I don't even need to leave anywhere to go do that. But there's always that kind of on the back burner. But at the same time, I still need to kill my first elk. So you know, there's a lot of other things I need to do, but maybe one day I'll get to that status to where I can actually do all those things. But like, it makes me wonder, what's the craziest thing you've ever encountered when you're out somewhere on a hunt?
Oh, wow. That's a good one. 'Cause I don't ever, as far as crazy, now you're putting me on the spot. I don't know. I don't ever look at, you know, I'm even trying to think of a time when I thought, oh my God, my life's in danger or something like that somewhere. I will say the thing that really irritated me, I was in Turkey ibex hunting a year ago, and when I travel, I always take my bows apart, and I build a case that's made for holding a fully strung recurve, or when you take it apart, the ends fold in and lock together, and you can put your takedowns in there. And when we went to leave Turkey, they made me take my bow case out of my duffel bag, which is the way it came in. I have it between the clothes. And they made us send it on the plane without being protected in my duffel bag.
Oh, no.
And not only that, once they did that, and my Aeromaster with my arrows in it, my back quiver, they wouldn't let me have that in my boat, in my bag either. So all that stuff went back to Chicago. Well, once they took them out, I went from two bags to four bags. And now they wanted another $240 to haul my bags home because I had four now instead of two.
I wonder if that's the reason why they did it.
I always say it was extortion. Yeah. My guide, we were in the back with people working there in the back room, and my guide was ripping them up and down. And I don't know what all he was saying, but he was ripping them, and he wasn't giving up. And they were holding the plane for us to take off just for Denny Sturgis and I, because we were in there trying to get settled up and get it straightened out. And our guide wasn't giving up and didn't want us to give up. And, finally, I got him convinced that we just pay it. We wanted to go home.
No kidding.
And because they weren't giving in. Yeah. So we ended up giving them their 200. I gave them two. For some reason, mine was 240. I think Den's was like 160 or something. I don't even know how they came up with that. Because they were sent the same way, you know.
That's interesting. So, but, I mean, have you ever had something to where it was like, today is the day I'm probably going to die? I mean,
I've had a couple plane rides where I was very uncomfortable taking off, leaving grizzly bear hunting. We landed on not really a mountain, but a big hill, but he landed like flying into the hill and landed going uphill. And when he did that, you kind of go hard into the hill. Well, when we went to take off, when he came to get us to leave, it was pretty warm that day, which makes it harder for him to take off. And he kept walking back and forth on where he was going to run and looking at the plane and looking things over and sizing up the distance. And I always catch that kind of stuff because I'm not a big fan of little planes and landing in the bush, you know, but I've done it a lot and I still don't like it. And I walked up to him and I said, what's going on? And he says, oh, nothing. I said, well, I see you sizing things up. He says, nah, we'll be fine. And I said, okay. And we got in that plane and we got all loaded up, had a guide with us and had my grizzly bear hide and stuff. And we're going down that mountain, going downhill, and we're getting to the end of where we got to be up in the air. And I'm hanging on now because it's not looking good. And I thought, and I was nervous as hell, and I'm hanging on tight. And right before we got to the end, it's like somehow he pushed that plane straight up in the air and we just jumped up off the ground and took off. And I'm sitting there and I look over at him and he's looking at me smiling. And he goes, see, I told you we'd be okay. And I screamed the F word at him so loud because it was looking really bad. I mean, I was really nervous. That's probably the only time that I got that bad. I've been on plane flight, bringing a moose out of Alaska. We'd load a little bit on the plane and the guy would look at his tires. Then we'd load a little more and he'd look at his tires. He'd load a little more and he'd look at his tires. And that's how that took a long time to get off the ground too. We were on a pretty big gravel bar, on that same flight, we went up above the clouds. They were pretty low that day. And we're getting back close to, this was up in northern Alaska, out of Dead Horse, Prudhoe Bay, where the pipeline starts, is where we were going back to. And I see his head bobbing and looking around the windows. And we got headsets on, so we can hear him talking to the tower, and we can talk to him. The tower just can't hear us, guys. And the tower comes on, says, we got a twin otter 6 miles southwest of Dead Horse. And he gets on and says something like, this is 011. We're 6 miles southwest of Dead Horse. And then he looks around at us and says, boys, we got to find that plane.
Oh, no.
And all I just had this vision of this plane dropping out of from above us or something. It was a little bigger plane than us and dropping down on us. And we're looking and looking, and pretty soon he says, I got a hole up here, and he dips down out of the clouds and gets under him. And that plane comes out about the same time the clouds just north of us a little bit and landed. And, you know, stuff like that, I'm sure it was no big deal. But when you're not, you know, doing that or in control is the biggest thing, you know. And that's maybe why I don't like that kind of stuff, because you have no control at all.
No.
You know, you're just sitting there. And whatever happens.
Kind of seems like a lot of the hunts you do, though. I mean, that's kind of your main mode of transportation, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, a lot of water landings. I like water landings better. I've landed on a lot of gravel bars. But it's just, and some of it's not so bad. You know, I mean, like like a sheep hunting in Alaska, it's a base camp you start from. It was a horseback hunt, and they have a pretty good runway that you can land on to get up. It's a little bumpy, a little dippy in that, but not bad, and stuff like that. And that doesn't bother me so much. I was really apprehensive about flying in a helicopter, and I never would do it. My wife wanted to ride a helicopter one time through the Grand Canyon. I wouldn't do it. I just didn't like the thought of it could just drop. You know, there's no glide there at all.
I gotta say, one of the coolest experiences I had was riding in a Huey with the doors off, and and the pilot was he was a Vietnam pilot that had been shot down like three or four times, and he said to everybody, he's like, you know what my punishment was for getting shot down? Here's another airplane. Here's another helicopter. Get out there and fly it. And he's like, oh, man. And he said, needless to say, I learned how to fly pretty good and take these things to the limit. And he showed us the limits of that thing. And it was amazing.
I think they're taught to put those down if they lose power and stuff.
Yeah.
Like it was... my first helicopter ride was in Northwest Territories, Dall sheep hunting. And that's when I was like, oh boy, here we go, you know, and that thing's awesome. I loved it. I'd much rather ride in a helicopter now.
It's
that,
pretty
that
cool.
I've been in one in that and talk to somebody that knows about it. And those guys are taught to put those down. Now they still wreck you know, I know people, but
this
people
guy
died from it. That, but
this guy was going 110 knots banking sideways. And right over the cornfields. I mean, it was awesome. It was pretty cool. And no matter what you did, seatbelt, no seatbelt, if you're sitting on one of the benches with the doors off, there's enough G forces to actually hold you in that seat. You're not.
You don't even feel like you're tipping out, huh?
No. It was pretty cool. That was awesome.
Oh wow. Wow.
I gotta say, after that, I was like, man, if I ever win the lottery, I'm buying a Huey. I'm going to learn how to fly it, and I'm going to get into all kinds of cool public places that nobody else can get to.
Yeah. It's up in Canada, Northwest Territory is the only place you're allowed to use helicopters to hunt.
Really?
Like BC, you can only use airplanes.
Hmm.
So, like mountain goat hunting there, they got to land you on a lake up high in the mountains.
Interesting.
Rather than... And because in the NWT, they can just drop you on top of the mountain, which is really nice because they drop you in a little valley or a little dip somewhere on top of the mountain. You get out, unload your stuff. You can set camp up right there and start hunting.
That's pretty cool.
Rather than having to backpack up to the top and all that stuff.
So what's that like? I've always kind of wondered. It's never been on my bucket list as far as hunting, but what's it like doing a sheep hunt? You hear it's like the hardest hunt you've ever done in your life. I mean, what?
Yeah, I love it. It's living off your back, and they're different. I mean, there's different kinds, but like the horseback hunts are fairly easy except for falling off the horses and the horses being a pain in the ass and all that, but you can cover ground. And that's a different kind of sheep hunt. The ones in the Northwest Territories, when they drop you off on top, you can just stay on top and hike and look for sheep. And, you know, just hike down the ridges. It sounds simple. I mean, they're still up and down and steep, and you can get in places where it's a little hairy walking and stuff when you're not used to it till you get basically get your sheep feet under you and get used to it. I mountain goat hunting is where I've been on three mountain goat hunts, and they were all way worse than any sheep hunt I've been on.
Really?
And yeah. This should make me a better sheep hunter. I've been on $5 sheep hunts and haven't drawn my bow yet.
Oh,
and,
no.
oh, yeah. Yeah, that's my claim to fame there.
My wife would never let me go on another one again.
I don't know if anybody can do that. Well, and to be fair to the outfitters, I could get within 75 yards, but I needed to get within 50, 55 yards to shoot.
Yeah, I mean, that's tough.
My recurve, yeah.
I don't even know if I have the confidence with a compound to, you know, I'd want to get in on it too. <That's>,
So anyway, I don't remember, 8 or 9 rams bedded down, and I was sneaking in on them in the Northwest Territories, and a grizzly bear ran down and chased them out on them. I was 75 yards from them, and I just bad luck with wind and Alaska. One year in Alaska, we couldn't find a shooter ram. And last year I was in Alaska hunting, and I had a really good ram coming right towards me up the mountain. I was on the very top waiting for him to pop up over the top. And he got, I forget, it was like 80 some yards, and the wind changed and he caught me and barreled out. And that was the only shooter I saw while I was there. Because in Alaska, they got to be full curl or 8 years old.
So how do you tell they're 8 years old if you can't?
The rings.
Okay. Okay. Yeah.
The growth rings on. I don't judge them. The guide does. He's the one responsible. So
no pressure.
Yeah. No, I'm not. I wouldn't judge them. But I mean, you can tell if they're really big. It's not a, you know, if they're really old, it isn't a big deal. But when it gets down to be 7 or 8, you know, it's up to them.
So if you could hunt one animal for the rest of your life and not hunt anything else, what would it be then?
Probably elk.
Really?
I love elk hunting. Yeah. I like backpack hunting. I don't know why. I'm kind of a big guy, but I love crawling in out of them little tents and carrying my pack. And my last real backpack hunt was on Kodiak Island in Alaska for a mountain goat.
Wow.
And it was definitely, I killed one, and it was definitely one of the best hunts I've ever been on. I mean, it was after I shot it, we had to hike, we had to take everything out and hike 13 hours out to the ocean to get picked up by a plane.
Really?
And I didn't have to carry as much. I had a guide and a packer. And when we got back, we weighed their packs. Mine was probably between 50 and 60 pounds, maybe. But the guide was carrying 117 pounds and the packer was carrying 100 pounds.
That's brutal.
And you're going down through brutal brush where you're hiking brown bear trails down that's covered with brush, and you can only feel them with your feet that you're on the trails. And there's a weed there, they call it snotweed. And if it gets a little wet, it's just greasy. If you step on it, there's just... you're done. You're going to go down if you pick up 1 foot, the other foot's on snotweed.
Oh,
you're
man.
Just going down. And my packer, I know my packer fell 5 times with a 100-pound pack on his back.
That's and brutal.
I fell a few times and I wasn't even carrying as much as them. But, then when we got down to the bottom with everything, we had to get to the ocean, and there was brown bears fishing in the rivers around us. We had to navigate through them but it was you load up camp every day while you're up there and move looking for goats. And, it's just an awesome hunt. Just,
that's pretty cool.
It was a great hunt. All the sheep and the goat hunts, I love that. It's just, it's getting harder and harder for me. And the goat hunts are just treacherous. On that goat hunt, they wanted to walk a ledge. We were up on top on like a kind of a knife top. And we were walking down it. And then we come to this ledge. And I don't know how wide, not very wide. It looked like about 6 inches, but it was probably 2 foot wide maybe or something. And it went kind of down and around, and I wouldn't do it. And I mean, we got a full pack on our back. All you'd have to do is, I'd have to turn the wrong way and it knocked me right off. You know, and then you'd fall however far it was. It was far enough you're going to die, let me put it that way.
Oh, that's always
and
great.
And so I told him, I said, I don't want to do that, guys. They go, what? You don't? I said, I ain't doing it. He said, well, we're going to have to go clear down and go around. I said, yeah, but I'll be comfortable the whole time. and the packer says, well, we really don't know if we can get all the way across. We were in a new area. They were just hunting. He says, we really don't know if we can get all the way across it anyway. And I said, well, there you go. And so we went around. I tell all these, you know, guys going on those kind of hunts for the first time, sheep hunting or anything, if there's something you absolutely don't want to do, if you're afraid to do it, just don't do it. There's no, we climbed up, I climbed up on a sheep hunt one time. We climbed up this pretty sheer face, and at the top, it flattened out and then went back downhill, but there was two rams laying up there. And this is in the Northwest Territories. And me and the guide and I climbed up there. Now, we didn't have our, well, we had our packs, but not full packs, because we were just going out from base camp that we'd set up. But it was, we got up to the top, and it was probably about 60 feet up, maybe 70 feet up. And when we got up there, what looked like it was a 3 foot ledge was about 6 feet. So I helped him up over the top, lifted him up to get him over the top. And then I had to get over, and I was sitting there and I was trying to grab the grass edge and it'd tear away. And pretty soon his foot come out. He says, grab my leg. And so I reached up and I grabbed his leg. And he was hanging on to a big rock up there, and I pulled myself up over the top by grabbing his leg. But that was a place we had to go. I couldn't go back. You couldn't go back down. Going up is and anywhere, climbing up is way easier than going down.
That's what I was going to ask you. How the heck?
Yeah, you have control going up. Going down, you can lose control so easy.
So how did you end up getting down?
Oh, we just walked around. It angled down. The only reason we went up that direction is because there were sheep laying up there, and the wind was right. Otherwise, we would have just went around, and we could have walked right up it. It was no big deal. It was just a matter of how we had to get there.
Nice.
And it didn't look too bad till we started climbing it. I mean, halfway up there, he got over these rocks were just so sheer, and took my stuff, and then I had to like keep 1 foot planted and swing my whole body around and get the other foot planted. And he grabbed my hand, and I was sitting there like spread eagle on across these rocks, and then had to get momentum to pull my body back over to the other side. That was one of the hairier, and that falling there probably wouldn't have died. It would have hurt really bad.
Yeah. But hurt really bad, depending on where you are, Randy.
Yeah.
Could be really bad.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I'm kind of curious. You talk about how you kind of tell all these, you know, newer guys or guys that it's their first time doing something like that to, you know, make sure that if they're not comfortable with it, don't do it. But what's some advice you would give a newer hunter, a hunter that's going on these different trips in the backcountry like that? Like, what's your advice as far as gear or one thing that you learn that you just take with you all the time?
One thing I carry with me all the time, no matter where, if I'm just day elk hunting, out elk hunting elk for the day or anywhere, I don't care where I go, I take a good bivy sack that weighs and that it'll pull up over your head. I mean, if you get stranded for the night, at least you can crawl in that out of the weather. And it, they only weigh, you get a good one, they weigh about a pound is all.
Yeah.
So you can put it in the bottom of your pack and always have it ready. I've only used it one time and for staying out like that, and that was in the Northwest Territories. We were 4 hours from camp and on some sheep. And basically, I was too lazy to hike 4 hours back to camp and get up the next morning and hike 4 hours back up to those sheep.
I can't say I blame
you. So I told the guide I wanted to stay out there all night and sleep in the rocks. And so he says, you really want to do that? I said, I don't want to hike back there and then back here in the morning. And so we just stayed there and put on a puffy jacket, and I crawled in that bivy and froze my ass off all night.
shivered the night away and woke up with some sore spots from the rocks.
He tried cutting a bunch of moss and making a bed out of the moss, but he said it didn't do any good. He still froze laying in that. He didn't have a bivy sack either. I think he put his rain gear on and slept in his rain gear.
I know I've seen some people, they take like a Tyvek suit with them or something, and they do that to where at least they've got a little extra trapping layer of warmth and keep some of the moisture out. But I don't know.
Yeah, well, I do that just because if it rained, I still was going to be dry. I get a bivy sack. I can't remember the name of where I got it from, but it's made out of Event.
What's and Event? What's that?
Event? Like it's a waterproofing material that the first time I ever heard of that, they used it in boots.
Okay.
But it's probably, from what I understand, it's probably about the best, and you don't see it at you don't see it in all the boots because it's more expensive to use.
So is it like real breathable or something too? So you don't get a lot of moisture trapped on the inside. Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, that makes sense.
It's really, really good. It's a really good material, for keeping water out and yet breathable. And
I know a lot of bivy sacks trap a lot of moisture and end up waking wet anyway. So that's a problem.
And on that hunt, that goat hunt in Alaska, I actually took a down bag, which a lot of guys say not to do, but my guide said bring a lightweight down bag, you know, bring a down bag and use a bivy, and then I slept in a little Hilleberg tent. So I was getting moisture in the Hilleberg tent a little bit at night. But,
you know, I've noticed I've got the Nalo.
He always uses a down bag, huh?
I've got the Nalo If I don't open up the vents just right or have them where it's stretched super tight, you do get a decent amount of moisture in there. I've also noticed, like, even if it's cold out, opening the vent properly, that you get a lot more airflow in there. Yeah, you're colder, but at least you're not getting so much moisture.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I normally always take my own tent. I have a Hilleberg Nyack that I always take with me if I'm going on sheep hunts, goat hunts, or whatever. That hunt, he had the goat hunt, and I don't remember which one it was, but he had a brand new Hilleberg that he wanted me to try out. And so I knew it was going to be decent. And I didn't take my Nyack, but I normally take my Nyack on every hunt for a couple reasons. The very first sheep hunt I went on in the Northwest Territories, we had one tent out there for me and the guide, one small, tiny tent, and we were tight shoulder to shoulder. We had bad weather, and we had to stay in that thing for 36 hours. And it was tight. And no more than, you know, like my Nyack, I don't even think it weighs 3 pounds.
So was your Nyack a one person or a two person?
They call it, it's like one and a half. They call it a man and a dog, I think. It's got room. The vestibule on it isn't real big, but it's got enough room inside that you can pull your backpack in with you if you want, and that kind of stuff. You know, there's room in there. I mean, it's not giant, but you know, for that size. But I after having that Hilleberg, I mean, I think they're awesome tents, and the Nyack, the tent is hooked to the fly, so if you go to set up and you take it out, there's two poles that go over the top that cross one corner to corner. You pop it up and it's there, and you don't, if it's raining and you set up, your tent's not going to get wet. Because
I don't know if I can do that with mine or not. I never
the fly's hooked to the tent. The tent's always hooked to the fly, I should say. So that's a really good option. It's like a,
as far as
the tent itself, it's a three season plus tent.
Yeah.
Because the sides don't go clear down and touch the ground like a regular four season tent would.
My
but
Nalo
they go down pretty far.
I think my Nalo is a four season then.
Probably.
Cause it doesn't really have a fly. It's got the outer shell and the inner shell. And then, I put the footprint on it, but I just leave the footprint and everything on it. And when I pop it up, I put, I think it's three poles.
Do you gotta have stakes for it to stand up?
Yeah. Yeah. You gotta have stakes.
The NIAC is freestanding.
Oh, that's pretty neat. Otherwise you're always searching for, like, if you're, you know, on soil, that's kind of looser soil, you're always standing around looking for rocks to try and tie it. And
you still do that, want to tie it down and stretch it out, but and use rocks. But
there was one night though, my ass was kicked so bad from getting up there onto the mountain. I said, heck with it. And I said, I'm not going to get any rocks. I'm not moving anymore. And, just kind of staked it out the best I could and kind of drew it a little bit tight. And by the morning I woke up and the liner was about in my face. It was sagging bad.
Oh,
it didn't matter.
It
kept me dry.
Yeah.
But I couldn't do it. I was like, it doesn't matter. I'm done. I'm cashed out. And then
I know the feeling.
Somebody made the comment. They're like, man, that thing's kind of sagging. Does it always do that? And I said, no, I just didn't care to stake it down anymore than I did. I think I used like six of the eight stakes, or I don't even remember.
Yeah. Just enough to get it to crawl in, right?
Yeah, pretty much to throw my pack in the vestibule and lay down and go to sleep. But yeah. So have you ever used any of those shelters or got into that kind of thing? It always kind of makes me leery about the whole open floor where there's no.
Yeah, well, for one thing, I hate mice getting into my stuff. I don't like mice crawling on my forehead at night. I've stayed in them floor and it was fine. I mean, I've stayed in some floorless shelters. I had a guide in Alaska that had one. He actually had a sawtooth, Kafaru sawtooth,
right,
with a stove in it. And we got one night, it got so cold and we got back and we're wet and it was so nice going into that thing. He fired it up.
And I imagine that'd be pretty
you
nice.
Can't beat it. I would do it as, you know, if there's a place, there's a lot of mosquitoes. I don't really want to do that either, you know, but they definitely have their purpose. They're nice and light. And, I know they're good. I know a lot of people use them. And like them.
I just can't see like a spring bear hunt or even like a early season elk hunt to try and use. I don't know. Maybe that's just me and I'm a wuss, but
yeah,
it seems like, well, I can't really see the, you know, without.
Yeah. Nice thing about them though, is you can put wood stoves in them.
Yeah.
But I think most guys, you carry a piece of Tyvek to put down on the floor anyway.
And that's, to me, that's just one more layer of noise.
Yeah, but on the floor sleeping. That is a problem with it. If you roll around a lot at night, you'll be here.
Absolutely. And like I toss and turn when I sleep. So I actually just, I ditched one of my sleeping pads. I used it. My one had a leak in it, so I hurried it up and ordered another one, primed it up, took it, used it, and it sounded like a bag of potato chips the whole night. And I'm like, I'm done with this. Yeah.
Oh.
I was like, I'm done with it. I'm not... I gave one chance. I'm not trying to, you know what I mean? It's just, it made that much noise. I said, if I can't sleep at night, I'm not using it. So I'm not going to say which one it was or anything, but
yeah,
it just, I didn't like it.
I run what is it? It's an Omnitherm.
Thermarest.
Yeah. I run a Thermarest Neo Air what it is. Yeah, I've used those for a long time. I got a couple of them. They got one that's a little bit heavier. It's more square, and then one that's rounded on the top and the bottom. And I've had good luck with those.
Yeah, I've
running those. They blow up about, I think they're like 14 ounces, 13, 14 ounces, and they're 2.5 inches thick, I believe.
Yeah, that's pretty nice. I ended up ordering a big Agnes. I'm going to give that a try and see if I like that one better than the other ones I've used. But I don't know. I've also noticed I'm going to quit using my breath to fill them up and use the sack that you're supposed to use to pump them up.
I've never, I got one with mine. I don't even know how to use it or what you do with it.
I'm not exactly.
I don't know how you use it for that. I really don't. It It's weird. The top, the bag comes out, and then there's like a long neck on it.
Mm-hmm. And it's open.
A continuation of the bag. Like
it's open.
I don't know. How do you hook it onto anything or do anything?
So, I just played with the Bag Agnes one, and it came with one, and I ordered the other one because it was the ultra lightweight one. And I'm definitely carrying the ultra lightweight one versus the other one because it's almost as heavy as a sleeping pad. But, so you take it, and it's weird. You like fold the top and you push it in, and then you like let it open the top again, and you can almost grab it in your hand and just like compress it enough to where it'll hold some air, and you push it down and it pushes air, and it takes a little bit longer, but I'm starting to think I'm starting to think that it'd be better because now you don't have your breath condensing in there as bad, you know, now it's just air.
Oh,
I hate having to fill them up in the middle of the night, or you roll them up and then they're frozen when you try and blow them up again. Cause all your breath in there. That's terrible.
I hate blowing them up at like 11,000 feet or 11.5 is where I hate blowing them up at.
Where you can't breathe
anyway.
Next
thing you know, I'm dizzy and spinning around. Can't stay on my knees. You know?
Nice. So, Randy, I got to ask you, though. So is there any advice that you'd give like a newer hunter or people going on trips and doing all kinds of cool things in the backcountry?
Yeah, one thing is don't go and worry about the money that you spent on if you're going to get something or not. You know, you hear that a lot from guys that, oh, if I spend that much money, I got to get something. Well, you don't. and you just, you're hunting with a bow. It's just possible things aren't going to work out. As you know, if you're going hunting is hunting and not shooting normally, depending on what you're after. I mean, there's things you can go hunt where you go to Africa, you know you're gonna shoot some stuff, you know, shots at stuff and that. You gotta wait, you gotta pass up a lot of animals, but eventually stuff comes in that you can shoot. But you don't wanna let that overwhelm you, that feeling of having to get something or getting down to the end of the hunt. You're going, oh my God, I spent $2,000 on this hunt and I don't have an animal. Well, that's the way it goes. You know, what are you going to do? You can't let it consume you.
So
believe me, $5 sheep hunts and I haven't drawn my bow.
Yeah. So how do you convince your wife then to let's ask you that.
You know,
what's the best advice on that?
My wife and I, when it comes to the hunting and stuff, it's kind of a don't ask, don't tell
kind of a thing.
I don't volunteer information, and she doesn't ask me, but she knows it costs a lot to do it and stuff and that. But it's I don't know how else to put it. She's busy with her own career and stuff, and so we just, I don't know. She's a good woman. I'll tell you that.
That's awesome.
Doesn't nag. Yeah. Never nags and I got it coming sometimes really big time too. And she stays real calm about stuff.
That's pretty good. So can we talk about some of the new products that are coming out or no? Is that kind of something we want to keep?
Yeah. No, of all of them, the bigger one right now is, I have a 2-arrow bow quiver coming out. And it's going to come out. It's kind of to complement the back quiver, if you want to. And it's so lightweight that you can tune your bow with that quiver on and an arrow or two even. But normally I tune it with one arrow, and because you're going to be pulling an arrow out of it to shoot it.
Right.
So I tune my bow and paper tune. I always paper tune. And you tune your bow up with that and take it on or off. If you don't want to have a bow quiver on during the summer and stuff, you can always throw that on. Your bow should still be in tune or really, really close to it. I tried mine with it, and my bow shot the same with or without it on. And I'm hoping to have that out in the next month, hopefully in the next month. Guys have been asking me about it and right now, the first one coming out is going to be a side mount where it mounts on recurves that have the inserts mounted in the side of the riser for 10/24s.
Right.
And it's just a thumb screw, the 1024 thumb screw that's going to hold it on. And so, and then I'll have a limb mount coming out a little bit later, but, I'm waiting for the factory. I should be getting the arms for it from the factory. Supposed to get them this coming Monday, so it should be very close.
Nice.
But and then for the AeroMaster, guys have asked for a better strap that goes across your chest, and probably by next week I'll be having a new one come out that you can replace. Oh, excuse me, I'm going to sneeze. A new one that you can replace the old one with if you want, that's going to be padded and wider. And because of the edge on it, if the strap gets against your neck, if you're just wearing a T-shirt, it won't be so sharp and be able to work into your neck.
Nice.
So I'll have those, and that'll be an option when people order them if they want to add that on. It'll work on any of them. Any of the older ones, so guys could just buy that and put it on if they want.
And Randy
and
go ahead. Nope.
Sorry. No, I'm working on a few. No, it's not important. I'm working on a few other things too, but they're so far out that I don't even want to bring them up because.
Okay.
I found out with this quiver, everybody was seeing it on my bow. I've been shooting a quiver like this that I designed. This is probably the third year or that, and guys see it. And then, you know, I say, yeah, I'm coming out with you. And then I get messages constant. Is it ready? Is it ready? Is it ready? You know?
Yeah.
Which is fine. I'm glad there's interest in it and stuff. That's kind of what made me do it, is I was getting enough interest from guys.
That's cool. That's awesome. So I wanted to thank you for coming on and giving your advice and kind of telling some cool stories and the insight from your adventures. Could you tell everybody where they can find you and your products and everything?
Sure. You can go to my website, safarituff.com, and tough is T-U-F-F. It's safarituff.com. I'm on Instagram at Randy_cooling, and also at safarituff. And Facebook is Safari Tough and just Randy Cooling on there.
Awesome.
So, yeah. And anybody want, I'm the one that answers the phone for everything. If anybody has any questions, they can just go to safarituff.com, go to the contact page, and there's an email there and also my personal phone number. So if you call me, if you call Safari Tough, I'm the only guy. I got help, and I got some good help with the company, but I handle everything as far as business goes that direction.
That's awesome. Randy, I appreciate you coming on and talking to me, and thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you very much. It was a pleasure. I appreciate it.
Once again, thank you so much for listening to the Publicly Challenged Podcast. I hope you enjoyed the show, and if you did, please subscribe on whatever platform it is you're listening to. Also, if you could leave a review, that would help us out. And you could check us out on Instagram or at publiclychallenged.com. And once again, thank you so much for listening to the show.
In Wild Country, rules were not created by man. Don't miss Wild Country, Wednesdays from 7 to 11 p.m. Eastern. Presented by Primos. Speak the language. Waypoint TV, the destination for outdoor entertainment. Brave anglers search for the one they call king, but who will take his throne? Tune in to Waypoint TV's Battle for Silver, Saturday, May 18th from 12 to 6 p.m. Eastern. Presented by Abyss Battery. Waypoint TV.